I worked for the American Lutheran Church Division for World Mission and Interchurch Cooperation for 4.5 years as first Assistant Director for Communications and then Acting Director. And during that time, part of my job involved setting up trips for people, members of our church, to go and visit the programs and people who are supported by their mission dollars in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and to learn about the global issues that face our church as American Lutherans. I had the privilege of leading three of those trips that went to South Africa and Namibia to see firsthand the work of the church in South Africa and Namibia, to learn about apartheid, the system there, to learn about our role as Americans and American Christians in that situation, to meet the church leaders and to have our faith strengthened and renewed through that experience. So I'm gonna show you some slides of some of those trips, kind of the three of them thrown together, and talk about some of the issues that we certainly saw in South Africa and Namibia. But first, just some introduction. Africa fascinates me. I've been able to visit many other countries in Africa as well, and I think it's one of the most exciting continents in the world today, especially in terms of the church. It's estimated by the year 2000 that Africa will have more Christians than any other continent on earth. Indeed, the center of Christianity, which of course began in the Near East, you know, in Palestine, then shifted up northward into Europe, is now shifting southward again. And it's very, very exciting to see how the church is growing throughout Africa and also Latin America at a time when our own churches tend to lose members. Those churches are really on fire with the gospel. And we have much to learn as American Christians from people and churches in Africa. That's my area of specialty. So it's true also, I'd say, of Latin America and Asia, but I'm focusing on Africa. Just a few of those things. The value of community, for example. We talk a lot at Holden Village about community. We all long for deeper community with one another. We know the disadvantages of individualism, and yet we don't really know how to build another way. I think Africa has much to teach us there. One saying that we heard over and over in South Africa is Ubuntu, Nguntu, Ngabantu. Bantu is the word for people in many African languages. And that saying means a person is a person because of other people. Not I think, therefore I am, or you are what you eat, you know, all these things that constitute us as individuals, but rather because the group is, because we are, I am. And it really is so true in African culture that the community shapes the individual, and indeed that a person feels the richness of that community's support and depth. Even though, of course, that is what causes many problems now as development comes to Africa, and I'm not a romanticist, I don't think about Africa. I know there are a great many problems. It's hard to find even one or two countries where the government works really well in Africa, and yet I think that continent is a very exciting one in terms of what the future of Africa. Another thing we learn is the importance of spirituality in a person's life. It's hard to find an atheist in Africa. It really would be an incredible, as Jody was talking about last night, an oxymoron, an atheist African. Those are almost two contradictory things, because the depth of spirituality in Africa is overwhelming. The church, if people are Christian, the church is definitely the center of their life. If they're of a traditional religion, then that is the center of their life. Islam is coming to Africa now and growing and evangelizing. That's a whole issue for the church now, is Islam, the Muslim movement. And Islamic people are deeply, deeply spiritual. Most Africans are really spiritual. And so I found my faith strengthened and renewed as a Christian from meeting African Christians and seeing what a central role the church has in their lives. Well, those are just a few sort of introductory remarks about Africa. If you ever get a chance to go there, I really encourage it. And both the Lutheran Church in America and the American Lutheran Church, and of course the New Church, sponsor frequent trips where people like yourselves can go on trips to see the churches in Africa, and I highly recommend it. It was probably the most significant renewal experience in my own faith that I've had in the last 5 years, was to be in contact with African Christians. Now a word about South Africa. It's a country I love, and I don't think very many people go there without falling in love with the country. It's very, very beautiful. The people are really wonderful, and that's what makes the whole situation so very painful, is it's not a country that you can disregard. It's a country that once it gets in your blood, it stays there, and I long to return to South Africa. I miss it. I miss the people there, and that's why the issue is so important. South Africa is a country of 30 million people, 26 million of whom are black, and 24 and a half million are black, 4.5 million are white, and then another 2 million or so are classified as colored, so-called colored, which is the people who are the descendants of the Cape people, who were mixed white and black, and Asians or Indians. There are almost 1 million Asian people living in South Africa, and Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, who did so much organizing and brought so much change to India, was brought up in South Africa and began his struggle there. Everyone is classified by race from the day they're born, and that is probably the most significant factor in a person's life that determines everything about their future, is what race they are in South Africa. It's one of the pillars of apartheid that has not yet been broken down. There have been significant changes in South Africa in the last couple of years, and change is coming quickly.
This microphone always does this. Okay. Crash bang. This microphone stand always has this problem.
I was last in South Africa in March of this year, so it was only April, May, June, July, 4 months ago. And I already feel like things have changed, and my information is out of date, but I'll talk to you anyway, even though I was only there in March. I do try to keep up on reading, and change is coming fast, but that one won't change for a long time, the racial classification, because that is the basis of the whole system by which they live there. It determines where you live, where you go to school, what your job will be, what your identity is, and things are really, really separated by race. It's the system called apartheid, which is the word in the Afrikaner language, the white Afrikaner language, for apartness. And the reason that we need to be involved in the issue as Christians is because apartheid has been a doctrine in the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa, the idea that God created us for apartness, that whites and blacks and coloreds and Asians are meant to be apart, that we're different beings in God's sight. And to that we can only say, in Christ all are one, all the barriers have been broken down, there is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free. And that's why our churches have taken such a stand on the apartheid issue, is that we believe it's a matter of heresy to not oppose apartheid. Is essentially to not be a Christian, because Christ broke down all the barriers that separated us. And as Christians baptized into Christ's death and resurrection, we have to speak out against that system, which is so evil, that believes that people are created for apartness, for separation. Another issue that the church has spoken out against, that probably is the most evil thing going on right now in South Africa, still going on, despite all the talk of reform, this is still going on, is the issue of relocations. People are being resettled out of their home areas. This map shows it in a very graphic way. This was put out by an organization called the Black Sash, and I'll show you a few slides of their offices. Very moving work that they do. But anyway, this is a map of South Africa here, a very large country. It's a huge and beautiful country. And keep in mind now, population-wise, blacks are 26 million, whites are 4.5 million. All the yellow land on this map is white-owned and white-designated land. Blacks are not permitted to own land in any of the yellow parts on this map. Even if they had the money to buy a piece of land, they would not be allowed to. And indeed, blacks have lived scattered throughout this land, but the red arrows indicate resettlement. People who have been picked up by the truckloads, essentially, and moved into these black designated lands, which are all the colored ones, purple here, green, blue, pink. And this is the land allotted for the 26 million black people where they are permitted to own land, otherwise nowhere. So you can see that South Africa is a very imbalanced kind of situation. A lot of land, the population density, I like to tell people, I don't know, I'll have to get some new statistics here, for the country at large is less than for my own state of Minnesota. It is not an overcrowded country at all. South Africa has a lot of wide open land. It's huge. But indeed, in these black areas where you've got such a concentration of population, there's definite overcrowding, hunger, starvation, overpopulation, everything that comes when you throw people into these very small areas. The red arrows represent more than 3 million people who have been relocated so far. That's 1/10 of the population of South Africa. More than 3 million people have been relocated into these black areas, which are called homelands. The South African government's plan is that eventually there will be no blacks who are citizens of South Africa, although that's possibly being modified now as they realize that they've got to take into consideration urban blacks. But essentially, the grand design of apartheid is that all blacks will be moved out of white South Africa, which is the yellow land, into these homelands, which is where they will hold citizenship. That these homelands then will become independent countries. Possibly, it could have worked as a scheme if the land had been skewed the other way. You know, if blacks had gotten a fair percentage of the land and some of the good land. But as it is now, it's impossible. For example, this is probably the most viable of the homelands. When Transkei and Ciskei are hopeless, those are those two here. The poverty and destitution are simply incredible in Transkei and Ciskei. But this is Bophuthatswana, which is the most hopeful of the homelands in terms of economic viability. There is one mine here, and if you point to any homeland that might possibly work, it would be that one. Sun City is located in Bophuthatswana. You've all heard about Sun City, how the white South Africans go up there to gamble for prostitution and all the things they can't do. That brings in many, many billions of dollars each year. Sun City is located right here, about 2 hours from Johannesburg. But Bophuthatswana, even look at this one now. It's these purple blobs. Here's one here, and then there's six others. It's seven pieces. But the land areas aren't connected. You know, if they would only give Bophuthatswana all of this land, it would be a lot more viable. But no, it's separated by these pieces of white South Africa in between. And you ask them now, you know, you ask the South Africans, okay, you think this is going to be a country with independence, with international recognition? Because South Africa is always trying to get the United Nations and other countries to recognize these homelands as actual countries. But how can this work with white South Africa in between? And they say, well, it's an island country. There are many island countries in the world, the Philippines, Indonesia. It's possible to have an island country with seven different pieces of land. And then you say, yeah, but in the Philippines and Indonesia, there's water in between the islands, not somebody else's country. But they don't seem to get it. So anyway, this is supposed to be one country here, but you can't, you know, you have to cross the frontier anytime you want to travel from one to another. Well, this is removals, probably the most evil thing going on. You've heard about some of the places that have been relocated. Majopa is perhaps one of the most famous, where I think the U.S. news networks even got involved there in showing how the people were being relocated forcibly against their will. But all over, there are places where black people have lived for 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, that the government declares to be black spots. And that means all the people have to leave, the black people have to leave, because it's a black spot in a white area. We talked with Bishop Sirote, one of the bishops of the Lutheran Church in South Africa. And I just was kind of making, chit-chat with him, talking to him. And I said, "So where are you from, Bishop Sirote?" And he said to me, "Barbara, I don't even know where I'm from anymore." And he told the story. I said, "Well, what do you mean?" All of a sudden the chit-chat had become rather profound. And he told the story of how his family had been one of the first families to convert to Christianity in the last century. In the 1900s, the Lutheran missionaries came from Germany to northern South Africa, preached the gospel, and his father and grandfather became Christians and were baptized. And back then, when you became a Christian, you moved on to the mission station. So his family moved on to the mission station there. But then, in the early 20th century, it was before the nationalist government came into power, that place was declared to be a black spot. The mission station, like so many other mission stations, you could drive all across South Africa and see these ghost town mission stations, basically, where the people have been moved out, the churches now are empty. That was declared to be a black spot. His family had to move. So they moved into the suburbs of Pretoria at that time, to a black township, they're called, a black suburb where blacks were permitted to live outside Pretoria. But then as Pretoria became more industrialized, as the population expanded, that black township was also declared to be a black spot. They needed that area for whites, for white homes to be built, because of course whites get the closest in suburbs. And so once again, his family was forced to move, and they relocated to we'll call it a resettlement area named Winterfeld, which is basically a big rural slum. You see all these rural slums where way out in the country, all of a sudden, there's 500,000 black people living, and that's what Winterfeld is like. But they've moved so many times like that, and this is a story many, many black people will tell you about, this forced relocation that they've had to succumb to. And it's very, very tragic. I'll show you pictures. One of our ALC missionaries, Philip Knudsen, and his wife, Lou Marie Knudsen, work in one of these resettlement areas. 5 years ago, there was nothing there. Now, all of a sudden, there's 300,000 people who live there, who've been moved in there. And Philip and Lou Marie are attempting to start some congregations to help people become economically self-sufficient in that area, which is practically impossible since it's a desert. And their job is to work among the people who have been resettled, mostly against their will. Those are a few things going on. I guess we'll start the slides, and I'll do a lot of commentary as we go along with the slides. Yes, questions? Uh-huh.
I came in late, so maybe you already told me about that. What were you doing in South Africa? Were you just visiting?
Yeah, visiting. A church tourist, basically. In fact, and it is with great sadness that I know that I probably will not be allowed back in, because the South Africans are really cracking down on church groups that want to come and visit. I was leading three trips with the American Lutheran Church, trips of lay people and pastors who wanted to visit the church and the missionaries in South Africa. And this last time there were four bishops on the trip too, which made it really fun and interesting. And you'll see some pictures of bishops all in their bishop get-ups and stuff. But this last time we were denied visas to South Africa. The ALC now, and the LCA, especially now that we've had some missionaries kicked out in the last few weeks. Two missionaries, Red and Susie Birchfield, have had to leave the country with their family. And so I think that I can pretty much know that I will never get a visa back either. The American Lutheran Church has a pretty radical name in South Africa these days. So it's sad.
Do you know any missionaries? What are they? Live over there?
Yeah, I'll show you pictures of the missionaries and where they live. And then I can talk to you more about it too. I know all the missionaries who are there, all the Lutheran missionaries who are in South Africa, and I'd be happy to give you their addresses already. Which one do you support?
Anybody else from here from prayer?
It's a lady. We just sent her a gift. And then there's another, a girl from Eau Claire that was married over there. Her mother went over, I know her very well. But I don't know her name.
Okay, well, we can talk about it. The American Lutheran Church has missionaries there. The LCA does not, although the LCA is involved too. And in the new church, you know, we'll all be together in having missionaries there if we can get visas for missionaries. Somebody else had a question.
What's the relationship of the color to the homeland today?
Why? I don't think they get any homelands. Coloreds would have, they will keep South African citizenship. They are frequently relocated in terms of being pushed out further from the major cities. And they're often, they're moved around too. They're given preference in the Cape area. So that on the map, they would be allowed to own land and live in the Cape Province, for example. They are not being given homelands in the same way. And so they'll keep their South African citizenship. But they, too, are discriminated against. There are certain things that coloreds can't do, places they can't be, and stuff like that. But they have more privileges than blacks do. And it's very, you can really tell as you go in closer to a city, you know, you start way out in the black townships, and then you move in colored, Asian, white, like that. But in the Lutheran Church, for example, this is the church that I always talk about because it's the one I know best. Coloreds and blacks and Asians are all together in one church. Whites have refused to join, but coloreds and blacks would intermarry. They feel a definite kinship. They are always working to break down those barriers because the white South African government tries to separate people. That's one of the really insidious evils of the system is they try to turn one black group against another black group or blacks against coloreds. And the church tries to build up unity. So they would send, for example, a colored pastor to serve a black congregation or a Zulu-speaking black pastor to serve a Tswana-speaking congregation. I mean, the church has definitely tried to build unity in as many ways as possible. And I know of some couples that are like a black married to a colored person. So those divisions aren't so sharp. Uh-huh. Yes. Well, there are some Lutherans, white Lutherans. This is one of the real tragic features of the church there, is there are four white Lutheran churches, each of which has congregations, and they have refused to join with the blacks. For the most part, they still use the German language. They're very conservative, like the Afrikaners in many ways. And it's very sad. They were suspended from the Lutheran World Federation at the 1984 meeting in Budapest. And probably the most hope for unity is in Namibia. I do believe that the white Lutherans in Namibia, which I haven't even talked about yet, Namibia, will join eventually with the black Lutherans there, but I don't think it'll happen in South Africa. They are pretty recalcitrant about relationships with blacks. We heard stories, for example, about a white farmer who died in the town of Kroondal, which is a German Lutheran town up in northern Transvaal. And the black laborers who worked on his farm all their lives were not permitted into the church to attend his funeral. And certainly they wouldn't be permitted to take communion. There are definite separations there in the Lutheran church. Even though, the black Lutherans were not allowed to attend a funeral in a white Lutheran church. Very sad. All right, let's start the slides and then I'll take more questions later. Is there somebody up there who's going to do that? Can you start the slides, okay? Okay, but you're going to turn the lights off? Okay. Well, which one do I use? Well, we'll try A, okay. Oh, can somebody shut the door, please? Thanks. This is actually a kind of a dark slide, so we won't spend much time on this one. But this is just to show some of the animals. I mean, South Africa, in addition to the wonderful people, the churches, the incredible... is that in focus? Well, we'll see. It also has some of the most beautiful game parks in the world. It really is a beautiful country. And the people are truly remarkable. The traditions and cultures that have such dignity to them. It's very sad to see what apartheid has done, and it's fascinating nonetheless to learn about people and their lives. and the church, which is the center of so many people's lives. This is a Black Lutheran service here, the women in their black and white prayer women's outfits, the pastor greeting the people. Sometimes the church services go 2 and 3 hours. It's really neat to see the worship life. This is on the left. There is Bishop Buthelezi, one of the bishops in the Black Church. Some of you might have been at the LCA Global Mission event in Northfield, Minnesota a few weeks ago, and he was the speaker there. It's a real privilege to worship with Black Lutheran congregations in South Africa, 10,000 miles away, to receive the Lord's body and blood, to kneel at the Lord's table, and to feel this incredible sense of unity with our sisters and brothers there. At this particular communion service, the pastor presiding was a man named Pastor Simon Ferrisani, who some of you might have heard of. He became, famous because he was arrested and very severely tortured by the government in Venda. Tortured to the point that one of his eardrums was punctured. He lost his voice for a couple of years. He received electroshock treatment and terrible, terrible torture. He's come to America several times to tell his story. He'll tell about his torture, but most of all, he'll tell about the love of Christ and the love he feels even for his torturers. We found out later, he's the man in the white robe there, we found out later that day when we knelt at the Lord's table, he was also serving communion to some of the very men who had tortured him with electroshock. We asked him, "How is this possible, Pastor Ferrisani, that you can do this?" And he said, "Because God reached out to us while we were yet enemies and sinners, and we are called to do the same with our sisters and brothers, to reach out to them, to our enemies." There was a baptism that day. Pastor Ferrisani baptized 3 children, and he had us as the whole congregation recite the creed and the Lord's Prayer as we do here, and also promised to be sponsors, to love and support this child. And so it's kind of neat to know that I've got a godchild 10,000 miles away there in South Africa who I pray for and think about. Pastor Ferrisani hosted us for the weekend, had us in his home, he and his wife Regina, and then took us around to tour the area. This is the police station in Sibasa where he was tortured for so many months. And the barbed wire everywhere is a real symbol of what's going on in South Africa today, the apartness, the division, the separation, and the violence that comes with trying to make a system like that work, trying to keep people apart. At least 2 cultures live side by side, the relatively affluent white culture. This is one of the hotels in downtown Windhoek, Namibia, the Kalahari Sands Hotel. You can see it's every bit as beautiful as our hotels. The cities are very modern, very clean. Whites do live in relative affluence. Many of them have swimming pools, servants. They all have servants. The standard of living is quite high. There are white Lutheran churches, and this is the big white Lutheran church in downtown Windhoek. You can see it's beautiful. And side by side with this culture of relative affluence of the whites, whoops, here, one more picture. This is the main monument in South Africa, the Voortrekker Monument, which celebrates the history of the pioneers who crossed South Africa to colonize it. It's a history much like our own. Whites who landed in Cape Town and then moved eastward in covered wagons, and you can see there the stone carving of a covered wagon. See it on the right there, to the right of the flag? They trekked across the country in these wagons, and when they had battles to fight, they would put the wagons all together in a circle, what they called a lager. And so often you'll hear that the Afrikaner mentality in South Africa is a lager mentality of sort of digging in, putting your covered wagons in a circle, and then just outlasting the enemy in the South African flag there. But they do have this whole mystique of the lager. There's a hole in the ceiling of this monument where the sun shines in one day a year on December 16th, which is the Day of the Covenant, when they believe back in the 1800s that God made a covenant to deliver the Zulu, the Africans, into their hands in the Battle of Blood River. And they did win this battle, the whites did, and they believe that's because of God's special covenant that God has made with them as chosen people. Okay, side by side with that relatively affluent white culture is the culture of the blacks. This is Crossroads, the shanty town outside of Cape Town, which is suffering such violence right now. It's almost being destroyed. But you can see the blacks live in these tin shacks, basically shanties, and in very overcrowded conditions. This is actually an illegal squatter camp. Blacks are not supposed to be living this close into the city, and the white government is trying to relocate these blacks who live in Crossroads 30 miles out to a place called Khayelitsha, very isolated Khayelitsha. I like this picture because it shows the contrast of the two cultures there. You can see overhead a South African Airways jet is landing at the airport, which is right behind Crossroads. So the jet juxtaposed with the white with the squatter camp here, Crossroads. This also is Crossroads, outside of Cape Town. In so many of these townships and homelands, the signs of poverty are everywhere. Open sewers, for example, no running water. Sometimes this is a well in one of the townships where everybody has to come to get their water. Dirt streets, garbage in the gutters, kids playing in the garbage in the gutters, conditions of filth. So that even though the country is not overpopulated, in these townships and homelands, there's severe malnutrition, overcrowding, and in some of the homelands, more than half the children die before they reach the age of 5. Probably the most moving place that we've taken groups to sort of see apartheid in a nutshell is the cemeteries in the townships and homelands, where you look out and as far as the eye can see, acres and acres of children's graves, little tiny mounds of dirt. All the graves are children's graves, practically. And this is one of those areas. This is a particularly fancy headstone. I don't know how the family could have afforded this, but I took this picture because you can see clearly the dates there. I don't think that's in focus, is it? I'm going to focus a little bit here. Okay, Rosina Macheke. Is that better? Okay, born in 1962, died in 1967. So that child died at the age of 5, and rows of children's graves you can see all throughout the cemetery. They're sometimes buried with little teddy bears, little toys, but the kids are dying because of malnutrition, and that's what apartheid brings. And then you see this, petty apartheid. This is rapidly disappearing, but there still is a great deal of this. Segregation of bathrooms, of park benches, of parks. And here in downtown Johannesburg, we saw these bathrooms that are segregated here. Blankies is the Afrikaner word for whites. So this is a white women's bathroom, and it's really hard to go to the bathroom in South Africa. Not only do you have to find the right gender, but you've got to get the right race group too. So it's a relative shortage of bathrooms. So this is the white women's bathroom, and this is the black, colored, and Asian women's bathroom. And note how those are grouped together, you know. South Africa tries to claim, you know, there are separate groups here, but then they lump blacks, coloreds, and Asians together in most of the facilities, restaurants, movie theaters, everything like that. This is the passbook that all South Africans have to carry that determines their life, basically. You at all times have to have your passbook with you. The stamps in it have to be in order. If you're in Johannesburg and it's not stamped in your passbook that you have a job in Johannesburg, you can be deported to the homeland at any moment. This really governs your life. Your passbook has to have all your stamps in order, and this is the whole record of your jobs and everything. The pass laws were abolished as of July 31st, I think, but they were immediately replaced with another law that basically affects the same thing that asks Per capita, South Africa spends 10 times as much to educate a white student as to educate a black student. Education is not compulsory for blacks, but it is for whites. And it's not free for blacks, but it is for whites. As I said, the movement into Johannesburg is very, very restricted. You cannot be there unless you have a job, and you cannot bring your family to Johannesburg unless you have worked in continuous employment for the same employer for 10 years or more. So many, many people come to Johannesburg but are not allowed to bring their families, and they live in these single-sex hostels, it's called, huge dormitories with thousands of people in them. People live four to a room in those dormitories, and then they would work in Johannesburg. And they would go home for maybe 1 or 2 months of the year to see their families, but they're not allowed to live with their families. They're not allowed to bring their families to the city with them. Here's another picture of one of those hostels. This is a little dark, but I'll read this sign anyway, because this is the beach in Durban. Beaches also are segregated, and that sign says in two languages, Afrikaans and English, under... Well, I can't even read it. But anyway, it says, this beach is reserved for the sole use of the members of the white race group. So any blacks on that beach would have to just be there selling candy or pop or taking care of white people's children, but they can't swim in the ocean at that place. Oops, upside down, sorry. Children hanging from the sky. And the conditions of poverty are just incredible. People cook on open fires. Although I'll hasten to say, and this is a question I often get asked, I have visited many other countries in Africa, 12 or 15 other countries, and you have to say the poverty is not as great for most black South Africans as it is for most Tanzanians or most Cameroonians. The issue in South Africa is not so much poverty as it is injustice. And it breaks your heart to see the poverty among blacks in South Africa, because there is great abundance there. There shouldn't be poverty in South Africa. There's plenty of resources. It's a wealthy country. It's not like Tanzania, which has no resources, no oil, no minerals, nothing. South Africa is a rich country, and still you see poverty. But South Africa is correct in claiming that blacks are economically, for the most part, better off there than they are in many other African countries. But the issue is the terrible oppression, the injustice, the fact that blacks have no rights, that they're denigrated in so many different ways. In the midst of this situation, the church is trying to minister to people, to build unity, to build hope, to build a sense of dignity. We visited the Lutheran seminary in rural Natal called the seminary at Umpumulo, and this is one of the places that's supported by you with your mission dollars. The Lutheran church is very old. It's more than 100 years old, and it's concentrated in this area of Natal. Here are some of the missionaries, Rolf and Viola Ossing, who teach at the seminary. He teaches New Testament, and she's the librarian. They're ALC missionaries. We visited Kotso House, which is the headquarters of the South African Council of Churches and also a number of anti-apartheid organizations. When you see the demonstrations in Johannesburg in the paper, many, many times they start here at Kotso House, and indeed one day we were there, there was a demonstration that the police broke up with tear gas, with violence. Inside this building, these organizations struggle to carry out their work, though they know their phones are tapped, they're harassed in so many ways. This beautiful banner greets you as you go in the door to Kotso House. Kotso is the word for peace in the Xhosa language, and then there's peace in all these other languages, Uholo, Kotso, peace, Ukulutula, Frede. And it's really amazing to attend worship services in Kotso House and hear so many different languages used, that indeed people do have differences of culture and tradition, but all the languages are shaped into one worship service where we sing and pray in maybe 4 or 5 different languages. It's really exciting to be there. And of course, Christ presiding over everything. Oops, I went backwards, sorry, excuse me. Black Sash is one of the organizations headquartered in that building, and that map that I showed you was put out by them. Here women are working to help blacks who are having problems with their passbooks. It's tragic to see how little they can do. Oftentimes the government or an employer will lay somebody off after, say, 9 years and 11 months of employment, so that they have to go back to the homeland. They can't bring their family to the city. They have not earned the right to be there. And there's nothing you can do because the law says you have to work 10 years. But many other times there are people who are unjustly treated, even in the laws of South Africa, and the Black Sash women try to help those people at the same time as they do a lot of protesting of all the unjust laws. Another worship service here. We visited different kinds of Lutheran institutions. The Lutheran Youth Center in Cape Town, that's carrying on an amazing ministry with the young people, trying to teach nonviolence, doing some after-school kinds of education and stuff in English, because the education for blacks is really terrible in South Africa. It's called Bantu education. And blacks are definitely educated for servitude. They are not taught good English. And the church is trying to help people get a better education. This is Philip Knudsen, who I talked about, is ministering in that resettlement area called Botsabelo or Unverwacht, which means forgotten, I think it is. Unverwacht in German, does anybody know what that means? Or something like the forgotten ones, I think. Anyway, Philip is ministering in this area, he's with Pastor Tsipa here in this photo. They are ministering together in this place which didn't even exist 5 years ago. It was just the desert, and now 300,000 people have been resettled there. And the conditions are just terrible. Here he is in a church service, but it's too dark, so we'll move on. On the right is Lou Marie Knudsen, Philip's wife. She works with the women in that area. You can see the houses that people live in. They were all relocated into this area, and what they found built for them was just an outhouse, a tin outhouse, a toilet. They had to build their own houses here, and you can see they built them out of tin. It gets very cold in the winter and very hot in the summer, and it's a miserable life in Unverwacht. But she's working with the women, the prayer women there, who are wearing their black and white outfits. Now, one of the things that is really exciting about the church in South Africa is to see how much the ministry lay people do. There's a shortage of pastors, so that one pastor would serve maybe 4, 5, 6 congregations, only getting around, you know, several times a month, or once or twice a month. So lay people do most of the ministry that pastors do in our churches, especially lay women. These women are incredible. They do all the visiting of the sick, visiting the hospitals, visiting the homebound people, visiting the lapsed members or the inactive members. They sing and pray, and they just do an incredible amount of volunteer ministry. And I think that's another thing that we can learn from that church, is sort of how not to delegate everything to pastors, because I think a church is really impoverished when we leave ministry for the pastors. And rather, we need to capture from these African churches the sense of lay ministry and all that that can be. Because it really is exciting. As you visit South Africa, most of all you see the violence now, and it's definitely gotten worse the last 3 times I've been there. This is a photo which has become very famous of the first child who was killed in the Soweto massacre in 1976. This year, 1986, is the 10th anniversary of the Soweto massacre, where over 1,000 children were killed, school children. And the violence has escalated. It still is, for the most part, violence against children, and that's one of the most tragic things, is to see how more than half of the people arrested are under the age of 18. And children are always victims in this kind of situation. This is a really sad photo for me. The man on the right, Linda Twala, is a youth leader in the township of Alexandra. He's there with, I can't remember his name, the pastor in that black township, Alexandra. I'm really sorry, I can't remember his name. Anyway, they were our hosts in Alexandra, and they took us around. And Linda Twala then invited us to his home to visit him, and we went in and had coffee with him. And you can tell that he's just a greatly, greatly respected leader in that community. We never would have dared drive around Alexandra as whites in our, you know, fancy vehicles and stuff, except that Linda Twala was leading us, and everyone knew and loved him, and so that meant that they loved us, and they waved at us, and they treated us just wonderfully. We visited his home, and he talked about his ministry there with the kids of the township, trying to help them not turn to violence, but rather work through the system for peaceful change. He is also one of the organizers of the demonstrations against the government. Anyway, he sent us this slide last month of his house, which has been blown up, basically burned down by an arsonist. And it's just really sad for me to see a man who I met in March, whose home I was in, to see how his house has been blown up, basically. Oops, I thought I had another picture of that. Anyway, you can see the door there is completely gone. The windows are gone. I've got some more shots inside the kitchen. Basically, the whole place has been demolished. He can't live in that house anymore. That's what violence does to people's lives. Here's some more of the prayer women. And this is another photo that talks about that violence, I guess. We visited Mahatma Gandhi's childhood home, the Phoenix Center, it's called. This was 2 years ago. This is one of his great-great-granddaughters, the Mahatma Gandhi Library and Museum here. And then in his home, there's photos of him and all his nonviolent sayings. This place, too, was destroyed last year by fire, completely blown up and exists no more. The Phoenix Center is gone, and it just makes you really wonder, what is the future for South Africa, for South Africa's children? Is everything going to go up in smoke? Is change going to have to come violently, or is there still time for nonviolent change? The place will be destroyed if it happens through violence, and change does have to come. You cannot keep the apartheid system working. So we, as Christians, and this is my sort of pep talk here, I believe that our job is to make it possible for that change to come nonviolently through diplomatic pressure, through economic pressure, through every kind of pressure we can apply or imagine applying, so that that government will change voluntarily and it won't come through a revolution. But that places a big responsibility on us as the world community to work and pray and do everything we can to help see that change does come nonviolence, because there's not much time left. The violence is escalating every day. It's already happening. The violence of the white government as it cracks down on blacks. The violence of torture of people like Pastor Farisani. The thousands, the millions of children who have been arrested or killed. The violence is there. And it's going to erupt even further unless we can force that government into changing. Okay, Namibia, another country to the north and west of South Africa, a huge country land-wise, a very, very beautiful country. I just fell in love with it. Country of only 1 million people, 60% of whom are Lutherans. And so that's why you so often hear Lutherans talking about Namibia, is that it's more Lutheran even than North Dakota. How's that? It's the most Lutheran country in the world, except for the Scandinavian countries, you know, where Lutheranism is the state church. Except for, you know, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Finland. This is the most Lutheran country in the world, even more Lutheran than Germany. And the big church headquartered in the north is called the Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo Kavango Church. How do you like that? Ovambo Kavango, I love to say it. So we flew to the north of Namibia. Now, this last time we were denied visas to South Africa, but granted visas to Namibia late. They thought that we would have already had to cancel our trip and not be able to use those visas. They try to get you. The South African government often gives you a visa after the fact, sort of after you were supposed to have gone. But we went. We organized the trip anyway and went to Namibia. We didn't know if we were going to get permits to travel to the north because police permits are required, and we were. Everything fell into place. We just couldn't believe it. So we landed in the north, which is where the war is going on. The SWAPO forces are fighting the South African forces trying to get independence because Namibia is a country that's illegally occupied by South Africa. The United Nations, every country in the world has declared this occupation to be illegal, but South Africa will not leave. They say they will, they say they'll implement United Nations Resolution 435, and they don't, they haven't. And it goes on and on, year after year after year of various kinds of denial. So anyway, there's army bases everywhere. There's a war going on. There's a 12-hour-a-day curfew. You have to be in at dusk and you can't be out till dawn. And the suffering of the people in the midst of that war is just incredible. Here's a SWAPO rally. You can see on the guy's shirt, SWAPO. That's why I put that one in there. And our group, I have to say, we are treated like kings and queens visiting that church. You know, in a country that's more Lutheran than North Dakota, they're happy to see Lutheran groups, and we were given the royal treatment. The welcome, the hospitality is truly amazing. I will never forget that hospitality. These are some of the members of our group. From the right there, Bishop Wes Haugen from North Dakota, Fargo, North Dakota. Bishop Cleopas Dumaney, who's the bishop of the Ovambo-Kavango Church. Bishop Reginald Holly of the Michigan District. Pat Swenson, representative of the American Lutheran Church Women. Dr. Abasai Sheavali, a pastor and the head of the Namibia Council of Churches. And then on the left, Chuck Lutz of the ALC National Staff. In front of one of the old Finnish mission churches, these people were converted to Christianity through the efforts of Finnish missionaries, and this is one of the old Finnish churches. The church ministers in this incredibly difficult situation with this war, with the curfew, with violence everywhere, and their ministry is amazing. They've got hospitals, schools, clinics, a printing press. They're really trying to serve people in so many different ways. And this is the Onanjokwe Lutheran Hospital, which was built to house 150 patients, but there are over 430 patients there right now because people like to go to the Lutheran hospitals and not to the government hospitals. Could you close the door, please, back there? Thank you. So, and these are two members of, okay, now I'm going to take a little, oh gosh, time is running out here. Well, anyway, what was so important about our group this last time is that we were blacks and whites together from America. And people told us over and over, you know, we go, what can we do for you? And the first thing they always say is pray for us. The second thing was show us that it is possible for blacks and whites to live together. We have no models to go by. We don't know if it's possible to have an interracial society that works. Show us that it's possible. And I really believe that's part of our call as American Christians, is to have a truly just society where blacks and whites live together. Anyway, there were blacks in our group. On the left is Val Starr of the ALC Luther League office and May Helen Jackson of the ALC Coalition of Black Members. People were really happy to see our group that included blacks. Here's the hospital. You can see overcrowded conditions, those beds out in the courtyard, the IV going there right out on the outside, and yet people love to come there because it's a Lutheran hospital and they know they'll get good care. The printing press. Bishop Dumaney there, always wearing his purple collar, took us to see the printing press, which has four times been blown up by the South African Army and four times rebuilt with the help of the Lutheran World Federation and our gifts. The second to the last time it was blown up, they just left the printing presses out in the field as a sort of monument to the violence and erected this cross there in the center as a reminder of Christ's cross. Now, what were they printing at that printing press that was so subversive that it had to be blown up like this? Well, it was things like Luther's Catechism. Here we went to the bookstore to buy some of the things that were printed there. Luther's Catechism in the Oshivambo language, hymn books, Bibles, and a church paper, which is the only independent newspaper in northern Namibia in this war zone. And that's why they were blown up, because they print that paper and they tell about the violence that the church is facing. We were received by the traditional king, King Eliphas there in the suit, and his wife here, Mrs. Eliphas. Wonderful hospitality. Then he brought out a whole bunch of orange pop, warm orange pop, and served it to us. It's really funny, you can get pop the world over. The places that I've seen Cokes are really amazing. But most of all, the worship life was what moved us most deeply. The singing, the prayer, the depth of commitment, the pleading with God for change, and the outreach through those worship services, just amazing. Always a processional offering. The services go on and on and on, 3-4 hours. You know, the men bring up their offering first, then the women bring up their offering, and then they weigh them to see who's given the most. Then the kids bring up their offering, singing, dancing, praising God, a lot of praying, probably 2-3 sermons. Here, I threw in this picture of me giving a sermon. I preached in English, and then Dr. Epsilon Hashela would translate into Oshivambo every line that I said there. Okay, now there's one more funny picture here. This is me standing in front of an ant hill in Namibia. That's a termite hill. A little lightness there. Okay, back to the city now. I'm out of northern Namibia. This is one of the black townships outside Namibia. You can just see the filth there. And the one of those houses would have 4 or 5 families in it. This is the headquarters of the Namibia Council of Churches, which was bombed in September. The whole inside was gutted, although it's being rebuilt now. Dr. Shayavali showed us some of the remains still of the arson damage. They've done a lot of rebuilding, but still things are charred. You can see the windows are still wrecked there. This is Bishop David Brown of the ALC's Iowa district on the left, and Bishop Wes Haugen, again, of North Dakota, and Abisai Shayavali in the middle. Wonderful, wonderful man. Incredible guy. We also had the privilege of meeting with the Administrator General, which is South Africa's governor of Namibia, basically, to ask him about the situation. We try, when we go on these trips, to hear all sides. You don't want to just hear the black side. You want to hear all sides. So, like when we were in South Africa, we met with some of the U.S. companies doing business there also, the 3M company. We met with them all day long to hear the perspective of a U.S. business. And hear their reasons for staying in South Africa and being there. Anyway, we met with the Administrator General, who's the second to the right there. That's one of his, I don't know, bodyguards or helpers or whatever on the right. And then the next guy is the Administrator General. Very gracious. He was really a gracious man. And all the whites we met with were really gracious. They're not evil people at all. And that's the tragedy of apartheid, is no one is evil, but the system is evil. And we need to work in every possible way for change. And we don't see a lot of change happening. So even though we had a great meeting with the Administrator General, we didn't go away with much hope. He believes that the SWAPO people who are fighting for independence for Namibia are communists. He tries to cast the whole thing as an East-West confrontation, you know, capitalism versus communism. Although many of the whites we talked to, including the German bishop, does not believe that it's a communist situation at all, and certainly none of the blacks think that they're communists. It's not an issue of communism versus capitalism. It's injustice and colonialism, basically. All day long, we met with different people. Here's a meeting with the church leaders. You can see that beautiful tapestry of the Good Samaritan story on the wall in the church headquarters. This is the white bishop there. Now, it was really important for us to meet with them because they have been expelled or suspended from the Lutheran World Federation. His name is Precis Blanc. Here, Bishop Holly is shaking his hand. And he really appreciated the opportunity to talk with us, to share their perspective. It's going to be difficult for the whites to join the black church because of language barrier and things like that. The German Lutherans like to have their services in German. To meet with the blacks would mean giving up German. But I do see some hope there in Namibia. And Blanc is the one who told us, he said, you know, I know what a danger communism is, because your country helped keep the communists out of my own native city, West Berlin. So I know about communism. I know how terrible it is. And I can tell you the issue here in Namibia is not communism. We don't fear communism here. The Angolans, the SWAPO people, no one is communist. We want, and he's a SWAPO supporter himself. There are some very thoughtful whites who do want to see change come about to Namibia. All right, I'll just tell you about the last day that we were there, the most moving worship service I think I've ever been at in my life. Well, I don't know, maybe that one with Pastor Fersani was more moving. Anyway, one of the two most moving worship services. In the Roman Catholic Cathedral in Windhoek, giving thanks for the release of 56 political prisoners. So we gathered for this ecumenical service. This is the spokesman for the prisoners, Joseph Chituvete, who had been held 14 years on Robben Island off the coast of Cape Town. There it is, Robben Island, a notorious prison. This is where Nelson Mandela was held for many years. These people were captured when South African troops raided north out of Namibia. They crossed the frontier out of Namibia, raided into Angola, raided a Namibian refugee camp called Kasinga. They killed more than 450 people at Kasinga, and they took the rest of them prisoner. And they've been holding them for 8 years now in Robben Island and Marienthal Prison, and finally released them through international pressure, the efforts of the Lutheran World Federation and many of us. Anyway, giving thanks for the release of these prisoners. Look how young they are. They're sitting here in all these rows. I mean, many of them were captured when they were 13, 14 years old. They're now like 19, 20, 21. Joseph Chituvete read us a little statement, and it was amazing. He said, it's significant that this Thanksgiving is not being held in a town hall, in a school, in a hotel, but rather in a church. Because it's the church that ministered to us while we were in prison. It's the church that took care of us, that watched over us. Many of us were confirmed while we were in prison. Could you shut the door, please? Thanks. And the church was our life. And so we give thanks to God and to the church for watching over us. And he read a Bible quote and stuff. And you just wonder, you know, how many released prisoners in the U.S. would give this kind of religious testimonial? And then we all knelt down on our knees on the concrete floor, all 4,000 of us, and prayed a prayer of thanks to God and prayed for change for Namibia, for peaceful change. We were weeping. I mean, it was really, really moving to be praying with these people. Oops, that's the end. Okay. All right, we have 5 minutes for questions. So, who has some questions? Okay, can you turn on the lights for me, please? Thanks. Constructive engagement has been the United States policy regarding South Africa since the Reagan administration came to power. It's the whole idea that you give carrots rather than sticks, basically. That the Carter administration was pretty strict, well, relatively strict. I mean, no U.S. government has ever been very strict with South Africa. The sanctions that we have against Nicaragua, against many other countries in the world, are much, much stricter than we've ever had against South Africa. But Carter did try to criticize South Africa a lot, and it was found that that was not particularly effective, in Reagan's opinion. So now they've been going with sort of the carrot approach. Let's cooperate with them. Let's build better relationships, and maybe through trying to make relationships better, we can bring about change. Regarding Namibian independence, Chester Crocker, Reagan's Africa secretary, dreamed up this whole idea, in my opinion, dreamed up, I'm really angry about it, that that withdrawal of South Africa from Namibia should be linked with withdrawal of Cuban troops from Angola, which was never thought up by the South Africans. It was Crocker's idea, and that's now what is stalling independence for Namibia, because there are Cuban troops in Angola, and South Africa is saying, we won't leave Namibia until those Cubans leave Angola. And so that idea of that linkage is part of constructive engagement that was proposed by the Reagan administration. All of our churches have spoken out against that. The one challenge that I wanted to leave with you, I guess, is we can disagree about how change is best brought about in South Africa. Our churches all believe that economic sanctions are very important, and I want to tell you a little bit about something you can do to support that. You don't have to agree with that, but status confessionis, all our churches agree to, which is that the issue of apartheid is so terrible, it's heresy, basically. And all of us as Christians are called to oppose apartheid in some way. You don't have to agree on methods. You might not think economic sanctions, I do. You know, you might think, I don't know, economic development or something else is better. We can disagree on methods, but we cannot disagree about opposing apartheid. Part of our Christian faith means we have to work for change in South Africa. So I'll leave you with that challenge. Even Chester Crocker now is admitting privately, I think the Reagan administration is meeting with the African National Congress now. They are realizing that constructive engagement is not working. So even they see that the carrot doesn't work because the stick has to come. Basically, South Africa is not changing fast enough. So many, many people now are proposing economic sanctions against South Africa. And remember, we have economic sanctions against a number of countries in the world. You know, you can disagree about whether they're effective or not or whatever, or whether they're even moral, but our government has used economic sanctions in many situations. And so a lot of us think that we need to have economic sanctions against South Africa, as we do against Nicaragua and so many other countries. The U.S. House passed last month an amazing sanctions bill. Nobody can believe what they passed. Basically, it says that all American companies have to withdraw from South Africa within 18 months. It denies landing rights to South African Airways in the U.S. It's a sweeping kind of sanctions bill. Let me see. I think I've got all the features of it here. Well, I'm going to put this up on the bulletin board, basically, that talks about this bill. Nobody can believe the House passed this bill, and now is a Kairos time, because if we can get the Senate to pass a similar tough sanctions bill before the elections in November, then sanctions will be in effect. There's no hope of passing them after the elections. It has to be before the elections, and now the ball is in the Senate's court. So I would encourage you, if you believe in sanctions as I do, to write to your senators, encourage them to pass the same sanctions bill that passed in the House. And it needs to happen during this session of Congress, during this Senate session, before the recess in November for the elections. That's my personal opinion. That's also the opinion of our churches. I mean, David Preuss, Jim Crumley, Will Hertzfeld, all of our churches are advocating for this sanctions bill in Congress. And if you don't want to support that, I challenge you to do something else to oppose apartheid. It is very important to oppose it. And I'll just leave you with one word here. The most important thing we can do is pray. Even before we start doing advocacy and giving money and sending missionaries and all that, if you ask people in South Africa, what can we do for you, they'll say, pray for us. I want to read one quote here from Desmond Tutu in closing. This he said to an American audience last year when he was in the U.S. We know in our experience what it has meant to be upheld by the love and prayers and concern of so many people around the world. It's almost a physical sensation, this being carried by your servant prayers. We are able to witness in South Africa as we do because you are faithful in your witness where you are. Because you are faithful, someone in South Africa suddenly receives an excess of grace. Inexplicably, it appears. Perhaps he is in solitary confinement. Perhaps he is being tortured. And instead of being hate-filled and embittered, he is able to thank God that he is alive and to pray for his torturers. How is that possible except that you have prayed him into that state of grace? And he goes on with another example, but I would really challenge you to pray for your sisters and brothers in South Africa, to work and pray for change there. It's a wonderful country, and it would be so tragic if a violent struggle erupts to a large extent. No one will win in that situation. Sorry to have kept you so long.